Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court will have three oral arguments. In the order in which they will be presented, they are, first, N. Ray Hal B. Kuntz, a petition for writ of mandamus. Second, Ford Motor Company versus Jack and Linda Ridgway from Bexar County and the 4th Appellate Judicial District. And finally, Texas Department of Protective and Regulatory Services versus Mega Child Care from Harris County and the 1st Appellate District. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The lator or petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. These arguments are being recorded by the clerk of our court, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a small fee. We will take a recess in between each argument and complete the arguments before the lunch break. The court is ready to hear argument from relator in Kuntz.
May it please the court. Marie Gates will present argument for the relator. Relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Marie Gates, and I represent the relator, Hal Kuntz, who here in this case has been ordered to turn over a third party's trade secret. What happens here is that the trade secret is owned by what we call Moxie, the McMoran Entities. It's an oil and gas operating company. Moxie trade secrets constitute the list or the designation of all their future possible drilling sites. Moxie gives access to this trade secret to its contractor, CLK, which has a sole exclusive is in the sole exclusive business of working for Moxie to identify drilling sites. CLK then gives access to its employees, which includes Mr. Kuntz. Now, right up front, I want to say that Mr. Kuntz does not equal CLK. The trial judge expressly so found, that's at tab one of our poster booklet, Mr. Kuntz is not CLK, said the trial court. Right, he is not one and the same as CLK. He is a member, he's a partner in CLK.
But if he had a dispute with Moxie about what his overriding royalty interest was.
Yes, ma'am.
Would he have the right to compel production of those LORs from Moxie?
Your Honor, he has access to the documents, but he doesn't have legal possession. That's part of my argument. And I think, yes, he would have to go to Moxie to seek production of the documents for purposes of a lawsuit with Moxie.
And so if he left the company,
right,
and wanted to collect on what he felt was owed to him with the LORs, he would be able to get those from Moxie.
Well, he would have to go to Moxie in discovery to get them. And you see, Your Honor, that would put it exactly where we think it ought to be in this case, because he would be seeking the trade secrets from the owner of the trade secrets.
And if he did, would you agree that they are necessary to a fair adjudication? If it were him.
It would depend.
If it were him.
Your Honor, it would depend on the nature of the dispute that he had with Moxie. And then you have to look.
If the nature of the dispute is, what do you owe me on the LORs?
Right.
On the overriding royalties.
In that instance, Your Honor, it may well be necessary with respect to the particular LORs that relate to the matter in dispute. But keep in mind here.
I don't want to go here yet.
Okay.
I just want to find out if he left the company,
right.
He left CLK,
right.
Had a dispute
right.
As to how much he was owed in overriding royalties.
Right.
He, you think, would be able to go to Moxie.
Right.
And if he could not tell what his interest was
right.
Without looking at the
right.
LORs,
right.
That would be necessary to
Your
a fair adjudication.
The situation you just posited is one where Moxie has already acted on the drilling site, because he's not going to have an interest until Moxie has already acted.
Well,
and at that point, Moxie doesn't have the same trade secret concern. Moxie said in this case that they would be willing for Ms. Kuntz to have the LORs that were relevant where there had already been an assignment. The problem here is the timing of when she
So you're saying if he were in a dispute,
right.
Then he would not be allowed, it would not be necessary for him to determine what they owed him to look at the LORs unless there was drilling already in place.
Right, because he would not be entitled to anything until action had already taken place by Moxie. See, that's the problem. She wants all of the prospective information where action has not yet been taken by Moxie. And that's the most critical trade secrets. That's Moxie's crown jewels as a drilling company, you see. And so
And you don't
think
the confidentiality agreement adequately protects that information?
Your Honor, they have argued that a protective order of confidentiality would adequately protect, but of course, under this court's rule in Continental Tire, you don't reach the question of confidentiality order unless the standard for production of trade secrets has already been satisfied. Part of my argument here is it's not satisfied. Now, the first point I think we need to look at is the steps from Continental Tire that we looked at in other trade secret cases.
Ms. Yates,
because
I'll let you continue down that line in just a second. You mentioned that the document should be sought directly from Moxie. Hasn't the trial court in this case already indicated he would not compel the document from Moxie?
That's the problem. That's the problem, Judge Wainwright. Moxie came in like a good owner of a trade secret would to try to protect its trade secret, and the judge, instead of ordering Moxie to divulge the trade secret, ordered my client, who doesn't even have legal possession of the trade secrets, to turn them over. And it creates a very difficult situation for an employee in a situation like mine. And I'm going to get to that. Put up the rock in the hard place for it, Kathy. The employee in a situation like this, he doesn't have legal possession of the documents. If he complies with the trial court's order, okay, then he's in a position where he has arguably turned over somebody else's trade secret without the owner's consent. You know, there's a penal code provision on that. And there's a remedies code provision that makes that a tort. And this is not some far-fetched concern, because if you look at the Amarillo Court of Appeals case, IVP Inc. versus Klump, it's cited in our poster booklet. In that case, the employee had the documents in his file cabinet, the trade secret documents. He gets a subpoena ducis tecum. He says, well, I've got the documents, and he turns them over. And the owner of the trade secret sues the employee. It says, you violated the penal code. You turned over my trade secrets. And the trial court gives the employee summary judgment under the argument that counsel argues here that, oh, well, you'll be protected because you did it pursuant to a subpoena. And the Court of Appeals in Amarillo says, no, you're not. You don't get summary judgment. You may have had access to those documents because they were in your file cabinet, but you didn't have legal possession, and you should not have turned over that third party's trade secret. That's the situation that we're trying to get protection here for a party who's being required to turn over somebody else's third trade secret. Kathy, give me the blocks again. Because when you wrote the rule in Continental Tire, you wrote it for a situation where the defendant owns the trade secret. Look at your rule. Your rule says the defendant comes in and establishes trade secret. Well, some employee of a company may not be in a position to establish the trade secret. Then the burden shifts to the plaintiff to prove the necessity for fair adjudication. Then you shift up to balancing, and the trial court has to balance the harm. The harm to whom? The harm to whom? The harm to the party that owns the trade secret. But if he's not in the fight, if he's not the right, he's not there in front of the court, if he's not the one being ordered to turn it over, the poor little employee may not be in a position to be able to put forward the evidence to do the balancing.
Ms.
And
Yates,
so,
I'm sorry.
Yes, sir.
Could the parties have avoided this situation by changing or providing in their agreement instant divorce? Could they have provided some alternative means to get this information?
It's interesting you ask that, Judge Schneider, because actually Ms. Kuntz signed the operating agreement that CLK had in place. She signed it as a wife of one of the members, and so she knew under the operating agreement that these LORs were trade secrets of Moxie because it says so in the contract. She also knew that her husband had this confidentiality requirement. During the divorce, she asked for the LORs, and their trade secret argument is made, and she never pushes it, so she never gets the LORs. So she knows at the time she enters into, with very qualified counsel, that contract, that there's going to be issues about the access to those LORs. But keep in mind, Judge Schneider, there's not an issue if she'll just wait till after assignment. If she waits till after Mr. Kuntz gets an assignment, Moxie is willing to let her have the LORs. The problem is the way she wants to litigate it right now. That's the difficulty, and there is an option here. On the steps, what we are suggesting is that this court needs to add a preliminary requirement before the first step, which is, the way I like to say it is, you got to have the right dog in the fight. You got to have the right dog in the fight. The preliminary determination is the trade secret being sought from the proper party? And you know, I was seeking for what's the handle, what's the legal reason why I have to be right about this, and I think it's Rule 507 of the Rules of Evidence.
But if she sought it directly from Moxie, we'd be having the same discussion, right?
Oh, Your Honor, we'd be walking up the steps and arguing about whether it was a trade secret.
But we are, aren't we? They've been before the court.
We are, and the reason that we're able to stand here and say on mandamus that we met the steps is because Moxie came in and helped us. But I think that there's a reason that Your Honors wanted to hear this case, and it has to be relate not just to whether this, in this particular case, the steps were satisfied, but rather, is there something that the court needs to think about Continental Tire with respect to a situation like this where I don't own the trade secret?
So if we were to write an opinion that said, case dismissed, she has to go get those documents from Moxie, we're going to end up at the same place, aren't we?
No. Well, first of all, I hope you don't write that kind of opinion, because this seems to me to be a perfect opportunity for the court to help the trial courts understand what they should do in a situation like this where there's this dispute that involves somebody else's trade secrets. So I hope you're going to take advantage of this opportunity to explain to the trial courts that you ought to have to get the right dog in the fight because, Your Honor, because Rule 507 says who can claim a trade secret. 507 is the
I hear all that, but I think then you're answering my question is yes. Then you're at the trial court with Boxy there, and Boxy's saying trade secret.
But my man, who like Hapless Hal, has an order. He has two orders against him to produce things. Okay? And those orders are subject to mandamus relief. In other words, if you said, Judge, you have to undo those orders and get it from Moxie, then my man gets the protection he needs. But you can't just dismiss the mandamus because my guy's sitting there with two orders compelling him to answer interrogatories and produce documents. He'll be in contempt of court. So but the point is that 507 says who can claim a trade secret privilege? The owner of the trade secret, the owner's employee, and the owner's agent. That's what 507 says. That's what you wrote these steps for, okay? My man, Hal Koontz, is not the owner. Moxie's the owner. He's not the owner's employee, and he's not the owner's contractor. So under 507, he's not the right guy to be claiming the trade secret anyway. And you didn't write the steps in Continental Tire to have somebody like that litigating the trade secret privilege question.
Let me ask you a question about how you see it working out or what you would recommend. Now, are you saying that they should be required to go to third-party discovery? Okay, that's what you're saying.
Well, and that's what they did here, Your Honor. But then the judge said, I'm not going to make Moxie turn it over. I'm going to make you, Hal, turn it over.
Right, but I guess they could appeal that, or they could have.
That's what I am.
I mean, there could be some type of procedure where once Hal gets this request that he knows he has some responsibility for trade secret, he could inform Moxie, and the court could formally inform Moxie, and they could say you better get over here and protect your trade secret if you're interested in it.
You're singing my song, Your Honor, and if the owner doesn't come in right then and protect the trade secret, then why is it a trade secret under Judge Schneider's Bass opinion?
But that's different than requiring them to go third party. I mean, by the rules, whatever the rules are for third party discovery. That's different than saying you can go directly against Hal, but Hal has a response. He can say something like, make a prima facie case of trade secret, or raise the issue somehow and install the production against him with the requirement that the court inform the true trade secret holder. They need to get over there to courts. I mean, that's two different
ways. Right. You could either say that the party that wants it has to do non-party discovery under 205, which Ms. Koontz did in this case, but the key that I'm after is to get you to say when the owner's there, the trial court needs to make the owner do the production, not the employee who doesn't have legal possession of the documents.
Okay, so let's presume we've got the owner, and let's go to the necessary to a fair adjudication piece, because
Okay, let me, that, I appreciate that, Your Honor, because that's a second piece. That's the second reason why this is mandamusable. When we get to the steps, and here the owner does come in, and so we're able to prove it's a trade secret, and the judge finds it's a trade secret. So we move to the red step, and Ms. Koontz attempts to show, to meet her burden, that she needs it for fair adjudication. Now, here's what happens. The judge orders us, Hal, to turn over every one of the LORs, the letters of recommendation that were written during the marriage, 1,784 by their count. The reason we put this on a roulette wheel is it's a complete game of chance as to which one of these LORs is ever going to give rise for any rights to Ms. Koontz. Because under the contract, Ms. Frommer, I'm sorry, under the contract, she only has rights if the LOR gives rise to an assignment. If Moxie goes out and acts on that LOR and Hal gets an assignment, then she has rights. So you might as well spin the roulette wheel right now. We don't know which one of these LORs is ever going to give rise to rights.
How do you determine whether an assignment's been made? How can she monitor that?
Hal gets an assignment. Hal gets an assignment if Moxie takes a lease on an offshore block, or if Moxie drills. All of these things are matters of public record, what Moxie does. But most importantly, when Hal gets an assignment, that's a matter of public record. Those have to be filed. And Moxie's counsel, this is at tab 6 in our poster booklet, Moxie's counsel even said in the hearing, look, she can have the assignments. It's okay with us if they give her the assignments. Moxie didn't even claim trade secret on the assignments, okay? She can have the assignments. And Moxie's counsel went on to say, when she gets the assignments, she can have the relevant LORs. Because, you see, at that point, Your Honor, Moxie's already acted on the prospective drilling site, so Moxie doesn't have the same trade secret concern.
Are you saying that Hal gets an assignment for every well that's drilled pursuant to the LOR?
Hal gets an assignment if Moxie takes action, which includes, in certain circumstances, leasing the offshore block. That's when he gets an assignment. But I need to emphasize here, her rights under the contract are more limited. Can we have that? Are more limited than Hal's. Hal gets an assignment if Moxie takes action. But under the contract that they're fussing about, okay, her rights are more limited. It's the provision 5.4 of the aid, and this chart shows what's on that provision. First, there has to be an earning event for Hal to get an assignment, drilling a well, taking a lease. Then Hal gets his assignment. But after Hal gets an assignment, the contract goes on to say three things. The assignment has to result from a project, secondly, on which CLK forwarded an LOR during the marriage. And finally, the LOR has to be a recommendation to drill. Now, what Ms. Frommer wants to litigate right now, she wants to pre-litigate with respect to all of those LORs on the roulette wheel. She wants to pre-litigate 2 and 3. She wants to make a list of all the LORs during the marriage that have positive recommendations to drill. And she says, I've proven fair adjudication because if you'll just give me that list, I will have totally adjudicated.
Let me make sure I'm clear what you have produced and what you're willing to produce. This covers 15 and a half years.
Yes,
have you produced LORs that match up with assignments where Moxie has taken a lease?
Yes, ma'am.
So we're only talking about tracks where Moxie has not taken a lease.
Or, correct, where there's no assignment yet.
And you said that even when there's an assignment to Hal Coons and there's been no drilling, that you're willing to produce the LOR?
If there's already been an assignment, Moxie's counsel has said she could have the relevant LORs.
Even though there's no drilling?
As long as the lease has been taken. Because, see, if they've tied up the offshore
block. And what about the backup data?
I'm sorry?
What about the backup data to the LOR?
Well, the dispute here is about the letters of recommendation. They have an awful lot of information in them, though, Your Honor. I mean, it's not geophysical run sheets and stuff like that, but it is the designation of everything about the prospect, the horizon, the strategy.
But they're willing to produce that as long as there's been an assignment.
The relevant LORs after an assignment. And it's not me. I'm talking about what Moxie has said.
What does Moxie say is relevant?
They say that was not defined in the hearing. But you see, Your Honor, I want to be clear that we're not willing, we can't produce anything. My man doesn't have it. He doesn't have legal.
I'm just trying to ferret out what Moxie says they will or won't.
But Moxie has said that they would be willing for her to have the relevant LORs. But the problem here, see, is she wants them all now. And she has injected a tremendous fact question in this case about what does project mean.
But now, in all fairness, mm-hmm. I mean, this has evolved. And it started out, my understanding is, that there used to be 10 to 15 assignments per year, and now all of a sudden there are none. And
right.
Hal's taking the position that to drill is a technical term, and we've gotten here because of what these LORs say. What is a recommendation
right.
that fits within
right.
the AID?
You're right, Judge O'Neill.
And so how can she avoid that if she agrees just to
she can
the assignment?
She can avoid it if she's willing to litigate it at the proper time.
On an assignment per assignment
right.
basis.
And see, she says that's piecemeal litigation, and what I'm trying to demonstrate to the court is there's no closure here. Under her definition of project, which we've given you examples of in the booklet, there is no closure. Every time Moxie takes action, there's potential disputes between her and Hal about whether that's within a project. There's no closure for her if she just wants to make this list of all the LORs that are positive recommendations to drill. Then she says it's just a matter of mathematical calculation, and that's simply not correct. And it's her burden to prove that it's necessary for fair adjudication. And the way she wants to prove it is she wants to convince you she needs to litigate it all right now so she can get a final determination of her rights. And I'm here to tell you, if she makes that list, it will not be a final determination of her rights. We don't know where Moxie's going to drill. We don't know what assignments are going to be made. And then there's going to be all kinds of fights about whether it's within a project, whether the particular drilling really resulted from the LOR during the marriage. There's no final adjudication.
Let me ask you a question about mandamus relief. You proposed a preliminary determination to see if the trade secret is sought from the proper party
right.
before we go into the other analysis. how can the trial court have abused its discretion in not adopting that a test that has never existed before? So how will that get you to mandamus relief?
He clearly abused his discretion here, Your Honor, because he had Moxie before the court, and he found that my man, Mr. Coombs, had legal possession of the documents. Now, I think that it's very clear that my man does not have legal possession of those documents. That's why the supervisor and IBP got in trouble.
So the preliminary determination is not dispositive?
I would say that the trial judge, obviously he needs some help from Your Honors now, but I would say that many trial judges would look at this situation and say, you know, Hal doesn't own the trade secret under 507. Hal can't even officially claim the trade secret. I've got the owner before the court. I'm going to order the owner to turn over his trade secrets, not Hal, who doesn't have legal possession. So we definitely believe this is mandamusable based on his order to make Hal turn over documents that he doesn't own.
But in trial court, once again, I mean, just real briefly, what, under your scenario, what's Hal's responsibility or what's somebody's responsibility when they get a request for production that they have, they can put their hands on at work, but they know that they have a trade secret obligation to somebody? Okay. What do? They go to court and tell the court what?
What do they
have to prove to get the court off?
I'm with you, Your Honor. The first objection is I don't have possession, custody, and control, so I can't turn these over. Okay, he can do that under the rules as they sit right now. I would argue the second objection is I believe this is a trade secret. It's not my trade secret, and I think he should have to get it from the owner.
And that should be the end of it.
And at which point, I think if the owner's given notice and the owner doesn't come in and protect his trade secret, then he has an established trade secret under Judge Schneider's Bass opinion. Alternatively, you can do what happened here, which is the plaintiff, Ms. Frommer, put non-party discovery to Moxie. And when Moxie came in, the judge should have said, okay, now I've got the owner here. The owner, if I conclude this needs to be turned over, the owner's going to be ordered to turn over his trade secret, not Mr. Coombs. I see. Red light is green.
One other question, Ms. Yates. Have there been no assignments since this dispute started? No assignments?
Your Honor, Moxie's drilling activity has slowed down. That's the reality, okay? I believe there may have been one. And it's true there have been fewer assignments, but, you know, to assume that that's because of something that my client is doing that's untoward instead of Moxie's activity, you know, assignments are a matter of public record. And she can go check the MMS over in New Orleans to see what's been assigned on these offshore blocks. So that's the answer to your question.
Do the assignments show all the working interest, let's say it's joint venture between four companies. Will the MMS records show all of the owners or just the?
The assignments would show an assignment of an overriding royalty interest, Your Honor, from Moxie to the appropriate party, CLK, and then what really happens is CLK sends Moxie a list and says, I want you to assign this much to Howard.
What Moxie joint venture this with? Amerada Hess or something
right.
like that.
Would
MMS records show both Amerada Hess and Moxie or just whoever was the working,
was
the operator?
The Mineral Management Service, I believe the MMS records would show an assignment from the appropriate party, and in the case of a joint venture, the appropriate party may be the joint venture, to the appropriate assignee, and in this case it's CLK or members of CLK. I hope I've answered your question.
Even if it's just the taking of a lease and no drilling?
Well, if the taking of a lease is an earning event and results in an assignment to Hal, then that assignment should be filed in public record. And keep in mind, we're willing to give her the assignments. I mean, Hal, when he gets the physical assignments, is willing to give her the assignments. Moxie is willing for her to have the assignments. So she, you know, there should not be an issue here of her knowing when there's an assignment. And, Your Honor, there was a whole hearing where an expert, Pete Huddleston, got on the stand and explained all this.
Well, there's a statement in the briefing that says Moxie has to pay royalties if it obtains a lease from the federal government, even if the well's not drilled.
Your Honor, that's incorrect. Royalties are not due until there's money coming in to be paid. What they mean when they write that sentence, and I hope that's in their brief and not mine, what they mean is that there's an earning event to get Hal an assignment if a lease is taken, an earning event for Hal to get an assignment. But Hal's not going to get any royalties unless a well is drilled, because there's no money to be paid in royalty unless Moxie is getting some money in by selling the oil, you see. So the royalties, the dollars, actually don't get paid unless a well is drilled. But they made the point in the hearings below, well, yeah, but Hal has an earning event and he gets an assignment if a lease is taken. We say, okay, that's true. He gets an assignment in certain instances if a lease is taken. It depends on who he gets the assignment from, whether it's a farm out from Texaco or something like that, as opposed to taking a lease directly from the MMS. If he takes a lease directly from the government, the earning event is when he takes the lease. If it's a farm out from Texaco or Shell, the earning event may well be drilling the well. but there's no royalties to be paid unless a well is drilled.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument.
May it please the court, Mr. Billy Shepherd will present argument for the real party in interest.
May it please the court, I'm Billy Shepherd. I represent Vesper Farmer, the real party in interest here. I intend today, given time, first to discuss why Vesta needs the letters of recommendation for fair adjudication of her claims. Secondly, to balance Vesta's need for the letters of recommendation versus potential harm to Moxie and Hal. And thirdly, to discuss the possession issue. And first, Your Honors, under Section 5.4 of the Agreement Incident to Divorce, Vesta is only entitled to royalty if the specific words of a given letter of recommendation amount to a recommendation to drill. The undisputed evidence is that there's no particular form used in letters of recommendation. There are no magic words used in letters of recommendation to convey a recommendation to drill. Each author uses his or her own form. Each author uses his or her own words. Therefore, it is...
Why wouldn't it protect Vesta if, after an assignment, the LORs were given?
There are a number of reasons. First is, notwithstanding what I've heard today, Moxie has not agreed to give the LORs to Vesta after an assignment. The record is very clear on that. Their lawyer, Mr. Rosenblum, has not agreed to give the letters of recommendation after assignment. That's a practical problem.
But if Moxie had agreed to do that,
it would not solve the problems. Secondly, it would require Vesta to, after monitoring all of this public information and seeing that Moxie drilled a well or made an assignment, to go to Hal and say, may I have the letter of recommendation? At that point in time, Hal has a tremendous financial incentive to say there's not one. That alternative requires Vesta, after the fact, to trust Hal or CLK to give her a letter of recommendation when Hal has a tremendous incentive.
My question is still the same. If Moxie agreed to turn over the LORs after any assignment was made, does that give you all you need?
It does not. Because, one, we know that Moxie has lost a number of letter of recommendations. That testimony is undisputed. Two, under that system, we wouldn't be able to resolve the dispute in this litigation. And I believe that we're entitled to do that. This court in Searley versus Searley held that contingent rights and property, unvested pensions, should be divided as part of the divorce. And that's what we're asking the court to find today.
Mr. Shepherd, isn't that the gist of the dispute here, that your claim is that your client's interest vests, if you will, earlier than House counsel believes his, Ms. Frommer's rights vest? Because of your belief and your client's belief that her rights vest earlier, you believe she's entitled to the LORs, even on wells that have not been assigned a lease and even on wells that haven't been drilled?
We believe that she has contingent rights that must be divided under the family code and under this court's opinion in Searley versus Searley now in order to put this litigation to an end.
What do you mean by dividing contingent rights? Do you mean guessing which ones of these are going to be drilled and how much they'll produce?
No, I don't mean guessing. I mean the court making a determination right now of which of the letters of recommendation constitute a to-drill letter of recommendation.
Well, why would the court go through all of that if there's never going to be any money and it doesn't make any difference? Why would a court go through 1,700 letters trying to decide that if nobody's going to get a check?
Well, I don't think there's any evidence that nobody's going to get a check.
You're not going to get a check off some of them.
That, I agree with that.
A large number.
I don't know about that, but I certainly agree that we wouldn't get a check off some
large?
Of them.
How large?
I'm sorry?
What is the evidence on how many of these letters of recommendation are going to result in payment to Mr. Kuntz or his ex-wife?
We don't know.
There's just no evidence on it.
Right. We don't know how many.
Well,
at all.
All right.
But in any event...
And so you're asking for all the LORs, whether there's been a drilled well assignment, just if there's an LOR that satisfies the intention to drill approach that you're talking about, you believe you're entitled to it.
We're asking for all of the positive LORs so that the court in this litigation can make a determination as to which of them are covered by Section 5.4 of the agreement incident to divorce. And another important consideration, I think, is by the nature of how the LORs are written, they often require deposition testimony and input from the author as to the intent involved. In 10 or 15 years from now, if we're doing this after the fact, the author may be unavailable, LORs may be lost, memories may have faded, and that would greatly prejudice Vesta. The alternative proposed by Hal in this case, which Moxie has not agreed to, simply won't work. With respect to balancing Vesta's...
But let me make sure I understand. It won't work because of the faded memories and they might get lost. That's why it won't work.
Well, it won't work, one, because Moxie hasn't agreed.
Well, assuming they did.
Okay, assuming that Moxie does agree, it requires Vesta to trust Hal, Moxie, and or CLK at a time when there is a financial incentive to say there is no letter of recommendation. If Vesta asks for it after the fact, and the answer is there isn't one, her remedy is okay. There's not one.
Why would Moxie not be forthcoming with Vesta?
I'm sorry?
Why would Moxie not be forthcoming with Vesta? I mean, why does Moxie care one way or the other?
Well, they had a 25 or longer year relationship with Mr. Coombs, and if you look at the services retainer agreement between Moxie and Mr. Coombs, you can see that CLK is essentially part of Moxie. There's a close friendship between the head of Moxie and Mr. Coombs, and I believe there's a possible, I'm not saying this, Moxie would do that. I'm saying it's certainly possible, and there may be some incentive for Moxie to do that.
How do you respond to the other side's argument that Moxie should be here, if not solely, at least with Mr. Coombs as a party to this litigation? Why haven't you pursued third-party discovery requests against Moxie and brought them up here?
Well, in answer, we did seek third-party requests for Moxie, and the court said, I'm not going to order Moxie to produce it now because Mr. Coombs has it. It's undisputed.
So you filed a Rule 507 motion against Moxie? I understood they just came in.
We filed a Rule 205 request for Moxie in this case. There were other efforts in Louisiana to pursue discovery from Moxie, which were voluntarily dismissed, effectively, based on what was happening here in Texas. But what the court here said was that I'm not going to order Moxie to produce them. And I think the court's words were at this time. And the reason was because we could get them from Hal.
But if they're Moxie's trade secrets, why aren't you pursuing them directly against Moxie?
Because under Rule 192.3, we don't need to. The rule is clear. It says that we are entitled to pursue documents from anyone who has physical possession. The undisputed evidence here is that Hal could walk in the next room and pick up these letters of recommendation and look at them whenever he wanted to. And not just for Moxie's benefit, for his own benefit. If Hal thought that Moxie was shorting him on money for Hal's own benefit, he could walk in the next room, pick up the letters of recommendation, and look at them
for
his
benefit.
But he
couldn't bring them into a courtroom and make them public without Moxie's permission, could he?
He could bring them into a courtroom, and this is where I think Moxie's argument goes wrong. They're assuming in saying that Hal can't produce them, that they're privileged. But the trial court has already ordered that they are discoverable in this case. Under Hal's theory, this court could order that these trade secrets are discoverable under a protective order, like Moxie shares them with their competitors and their consultants. Yet, we can't get them from Hal, even though he has physical possession of them. He can walk in the next room and get them, and Rule 192.3 says we can, simply because they are, quote-unquote, owned by Moxie.
Well, let's take this into the tire litigation, for example, another area. Let's suppose a plaintiff's expert in the tire litigation had access under a court order to tire trade secrets, some of our tire cases. And a plaintiff in another case sues the expert and says, turn over that tire company's trade secrets. Do you think a trial court has authority under their circumstances to not consider the tire company's arguments and order directly from the plaintiff's expert turn over the third party's trade secrets?
Not without the tire company being notified and given an opportunity.
And if they come in and object, then what?
And if they come in, if the tire company comes in and objects and says their piece, and it is determined that either they're not trade secrets or they're needed for a fair adjudication of the litigation, absolutely the expert could turn them over. Absolutely. And that's what happened here.
So would the order be against the expert or the TARP?
The expert. Ownership's not the issue. And that's what's happened here. Moxie has participated in every single stage of this proceeding. They filed objections, briefs, and made arguments in the trial court. They participated in the Court of Appeals. They filed at least two briefs in this court here. The effect of this court saying that these are discoverable because they're needed, but you have to go get them from Moxie, I don't think our judicial system's that inefficient. The issue here is physical possession, custody, or control. Because Moxie has had the opportunity every step of the way and has, in fact, participated
could,
every step of the
Moxie,
way.
I may answer my own question, but Moxie, would they have any legal right to file their own mandamus to say that about this order? This order doesn't go to them. It goes to Howe. So they, in some sense, they have to rely on Howe to protect their rights. Shouldn't they have an independent order against them where they can protect themselves?
I think Moxie could file a mandamus. They've chosen to appear in the case. They've chosen to say they're a party of interest. They've chosen to say that these alleged trade secrets are theirs. They participated every step of the way. I think they could have sought affirmative relief if they wanted to.
Are the assignments a matter of public record or not?
According to Moxie's experts, when an assignment is made, it is filed in the MMS in New Orleans.
So VESTA would have notice each time an assignment was made?
If VESTA went to New Orleans or otherwise monitored the MMS, VESTA would be able to, assuming that there were no mistakes, would be able to find out when assignment.
Then to get back to Justice Wainwright's question, why should we say that her rights vest before his does if the assignment is a matter of public record? In other words, why should she be entitled to these LORs before the assignment is made if, when it is made, she has access to them through public records?
Because both Vesta and Howe right now have a contingent right in the property, and under this court's opinion in Searley versus Searley, I believe that should be divided. Secondly, under the theory of the after the fact, the look back theory, that will not end this litigation. It will require multiple suits in the future if there's a disagreement on what constitutes two drill. And I might add that that is exactly what this court said in Searley versus Searley when it divided a contingent right to pension property. What this court said is, if we don't do this now, it will result in a multiplicity of suits. And that's exactly what's going to happen here. If the court doesn't do this now, it will result in a multiplicity of suits.
Mr. Shepherd, I'm not entirely clear about Moxie's involvement at the trial court. Was there a formal discovery request propounded to Moxie for these LORs?
There was a discovery request.
Was there a trial court order signed on that?
I don't know that there was an order signed. The trial court certainly on the record said, I am not ordering Moxie to produce anything at this time. And when we read the record, and it's part of the record before this court, you can see the court said that based on Hal has this stuff. You can get it from Hal if you're entitled to it.
So your understanding is there was no order signed. The court indicated that in a hearing.
I'm not aware of any such order.
Well, I keep getting back to what Hal's argument would be if Hal left the company, because it strikes me that Vesta's rights would be the same as his in that scenario. And so if he were to leave the company and sue Moxie for these LORs, and they asserted trade secret status, and he then had to show they were necessary for a fair adjudication, what would his argument be as to why they are necessary?
He would need to know, for example, he needs them because he knows where wells have been drilled. He would need the LORs to see if there was a letter of recommendation for that location or that block or that reservoir.
Only after, I mean, he could get what he needed after the wells have been drilled.
Assuming that he trusted Moxie, and I think Mr. Coombs does in fact trust Moxie, yes, to give him LORs. Now, I think that it would be unfathomable that Mr. Coombs or CLK, whose only client is Moxie, would give away all of their records that show what and when they're entitled to revenue. I don't think that's a very realistic scenario. But, to answer your question, if he trusted Moxie, he could get them.
I may be missing something, but Vesta is entitled to 25% of Howell's royalties at most. I mean, say if all these LORs come under to drill, which they're not going to, but at most, she's entitled to 25% of what he gets on these royalties.
That's correct.
So, couldn't she somehow monitor his income or tax return to see what royalties he gets paid in the future, and then go beyond that and look at the LORs that are, that income derives from? I mean, Hal's not going to turn away money, presumably, just to make sure his wife doesn't get 25% of it.
Right.
Is that a way to protect? I mean, her basic legal right is 25% of these, of some part of these royalties, and we're trying to balance that versus the trade secret. So is that a way that she can ensure that she gets her 25% without looking at all?
I don't think there's any way for Vesta to monitor Hal's tax returns or income. There may be a way for Vesta to monitor assignments from Moxie, but the problem is that Vesta then goes to Hal and says, was this the result of a letter of recommendation during the marriage? And Hal says, no. Vesta says, okay. There's no check for Vesta. She has to trust Hal. What we know about Moxie is that they trust these letters of recommendation with their competitors with the confidentiality agreement. They trust these letters of recommendation with their employees without a confidentiality agreement. They trust these letters of recommendation with their outside consultants with a 3-year confidentiality agreement. And I might add, if Vesta would have signed the confidentiality agreement in June of 1999, when she signed the agreement incident to divorce, it would be over already and she would be free to use this information. But Moxie apparently won't trust Vesta with this information with a confidentiality agreement. And this is even though that Vesta's interests are aligned exactly with Hal's interests.
Well, that's why I keep getting back to that question. If he were to leave and sue, I believe I heard you say that they'd be willing to give it to him, give the LORs to him, but they would not be required to. They could probably protect them as trade secrets.
I don't think how would need them for fair adjudication of his claims.
Why?
Because without the LORs to show whether whatever well Moxie drilled resulted from a recommendation from CLK.
But wouldn't he have to wait until the wells were drilled to seek the LORs?
No, I don't think he would. I don't think he would if he did wait.
Well, I mean, if they established trade secret status and he did have to show it was necessary to a fair adjudication, which is a very tight and difficult test to meet, how would he overcome the argument that you can get them once the well's drilled, then you can see them?
I think there would have to be some dispute ongoing. I mean, but, to the extent some dispute was ongoing, I don't think he would have to wait and do it after the fact. And certainly not in a family law context where courts are charged with dividing the entire estate, including, according to this court, contingent rights such as unvested pension plans, which may never vest. Not one penny may result from these unvested pension plans, such was at issue in Searley versus Searley. Nevertheless, this court held that it was appropriate to divide that to avoid a multiplicity of suits. And that's exactly what we're going to have here if we can't get this issue resolved in this suit. Every time Vesta and Hal disagree as to whether the unique words of a letter of recommendation constitute a recommendation or drill, we're going to file another lawsuit. Might be 5 years from now, might be 10, might be 15, could be longer.
So you envision getting an order that goes through 1,700 some odd LORs and one by one say yes, no?
Well, I think first, if you look at the LORs, there are going to be some of them that can be agreed on immediately, and then we just kick those out. Now we've not seen them, so we don't know what we can agree on, what we can't. But there'll be a number that you can agree on immediately and kick them out, and then there'll be a number with which there is a dispute, and that dispute is either going to be decided as a legal matter by the judge or a potentially by jury.
So where do these LORs, where are they deposited pending the 10, 15, 20 years it may take Moxie or somebody else to drill them?
Well, that's a good question. They were, the LORs were contained in CLK's office as well as a copy in Moxie's offices. At the time the order was entered in this court saying that Howe had possession, custody, or control of the documents and needs to produce them. But while this proceeding was pending, Moxie wrote Howe a letter and said, give us back all of our LORs. And in the face of a court order saying, Howe, you have to produce them, and in the face of a court order saying, Howe, you have possession, custody, or control of them, they shipped them all to Louisiana, according to what they say. And that happened after this proceeding was pending. They notified us that that happened after they had already shipped them away.
I'm just saying, you've got a court order that has 1,700 LORs listed. They've got to be identified some way in the court order. But ultimately, as a well is drilled, don't you still have to compare the actual LOR with the property and make sense?
Sure. I mean,
where do the LORs, who will have custody, control, possession of the LORs that are identified in the court order while Moxie decides to drill or not over the next decade or so?
I think Vesta, under an appropriate confidentiality agreement, and she will agree to any reasonable confidentiality agreement or order, and by Vesta, maybe her attorney would hold a set, as well as, of course, House.
I just have a quick question about Vesta's former attorney, Mr. Bowen. He's filed several papers in this matter. Just factually, his case has been severed out against Vesta, and he's asking for attorney's fees, and she's counterclaiming for malpractice, and that's still pending. Is that right? Hadn't been resolved?
That is pending.
All right. He claims that his rights will somehow be affected by this court's resolution of this mandamus. What's your short answer?
I don't know why his rights would be affected at all by this mandamus.
He doesn't explain it very much, but
I don't think so.
Okay.
Mr. Shepherd, a good trial judge heard all of these arguments, or I'm sure at least the gist of these arguments, and ordered production of all the LORs without a vesting, if you will, even though the rights were, as you called it, contingent. Is there any evidence in the record why he decided that? Did he decide that your point of view about Ms. Frommer's rights, that they were contingent and that entitled her to these documents, was correct? Did he decide that Mr. Koontz's apartment CLK could get money from the wells without them? Is there anything in the record to indicate why the trial judge ordered production of documents, 1,800 total, or more, and probably many more pages, when there's this big dispute about when the rights vest, which obviously can determine what the relevant scope of documents is?
After hearing 2 days of evidence, I think that the record indicates that the judge found that Vesta needs them so that her rights can be determined in this suit. And I might add, the judge did say about his ruling with respect to the CLK operating agreement that Ms. Yates referenced, that Ms. Frommer signed, that in that agreement, the confidentiality provision specifically excepted Howe from disclosing information to Vesta. Spouses were accepted from the confidentiality agreement contained in the operating agreement that Ms. Yates referenced.
And that's in our record?
That is in your record, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Your Honor, spouses were accepted in the sense that spouses are not subject to the confidentiality part of the contract. Spouses are not accepted in the sense that they intended for members of CLK to give information to spouses. I just want to clear that up. Chief Justice Phillips, Moxie was brought in by a non-party. It was CLK that just showed up and intervened to try to protect its interests. You know, we talk about confidentiality orders, but I think we need to remember that that's the last step. And under Your Honor's opinion, including in what you said in Bass, Justice Schneider, it's mandamusable to order trade secrets to be turned over if she has failed to prove fair adjudication necessary for fair adjudication, even if you give a confidentiality one. And I want to be clear that you just heard his argument on necessary for fair adjudication. The reason that they say they have met their burden of proof is this need to adjudicate it all right now. That's his proof on why it's necessary. And what I'm trying to make clear is that it will not be a final determination. Just as Justice Owen said, every time Moxie drills, you're still going to have to look at it and figure out whether it fits with one of the LORs, whether it fits her definition of project. So there's no closure here for her.
What are the issues in project? I'm not sure I understand.
Okay. Your Honor,
it seems to me like all be a project or none of them.
Right, exactly. She has put in her declaratory judgment petition that she wants the judge to adopt her definition of project. We think project means prospect. Her definition of project is it's broader than that, see, and that's what these pictures are designed to show. You may have a prospect. This is tab 7. You may have a prospect that was an LOR during the marriage. That's the red blob. But she wants to adopt a definition of project where she says, well, a project is broader, and a project could start with an LOR during the marriage, but then expand out and cover something that was not an LOR during the marriage because it's part of a project. And that could cover other blocks. That's the second picture. You may have a prospect during the marriage that was in one block, but under her project argument, it could span to another block. And the reason that I put this in, and the expert talked about this in the hearing, but the reason I put it in is to show you that there's no closure. The list that she wants to make is not going to get her to a final adjudication of her rights. And counsel keeps saying this is a family law dispute and the rights haven't been divided. Your Honors, the rights are divided. The agreement in aid of divorce in Section 504 divides these rights. And what we've got here is a contract dispute over what that contract means. The rights are divided under the family law context. This is a contract dispute about what does that contract mean. So there's nothing peculiar.
But the divorce judge would have continuing jurisdiction.
Well, that's true.
As one of these comes up to decide if it's a...
That's true, Your Honor. That's true. Now, could I just point out that I don't think she's met her burden of proof under the red step, the fair adjudication, but then you'd move to the balancing step, which is the blue step. And here again, I think the judge has committed a clear abuse of discretion or clear error of law. Look what he's balancing. He's supposed to be balancing her need to adjudicate right now. She wants to adjudicate all of these LORs on the roulette wheel, a huge waste of judicial resources. You heard counsel say we're going to have experts come in, we're going to have fact witnesses, we're going to have a jury trial on all of those LORs on the roulette wheel so she can make this list. But he's balancing her need to do that against the harm to Moxie, who could lose hundreds of millions if this LORs get into somebody else's hands. And, you know, he says, well, you give them to your other companies under a confidentiality agreement. That's Moxie deciding to give one LOR or two LORs to another company to interest them in joining. And that company, that's Moxie deciding, well, you know, I think Shell or Texaco, they could respond if they divulge my trade secret. Ms. Frober can't respond. She can't pay $100 million if she divulges Moxie's trade secret.
How much can you share information with someone before it ceases to be a trade secret?
You have to meet the test from the Bass case to maintain trade secrecy. So you have to maintain the standards of care to keep it a trade secret. But I would argue that with the oil and gas industry won't be able to function unless they can share in the limited context that Moxie does with their employees and with others that they want to interest in joint venture context subject to confidentiality agreements. So then the other is CLK.
About the fact that Moxie has produced some of these?
Produced, you mean in the...
How many LORs has Moxie produced already?
The Louisiana lawsuit that's referenced in the record, they produced a handful after assignment, okay? In this lawsuit, the judge had ordered redacted LORs to be produced, and we produced 155 redacted LORs. Redacted to take out the locations of the prospects. But you see, then the judge ordered us to produce them all unredacted, to give her the location of the prospects. And some wonderful questions were asked about all of this is going to be in Ms. Frommer's hands for the next 20 years, all Moxie's secrets. We think that the judge erred in the balancing context here. The physical possession point, I hope the court writes on that.
Any other questions?
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument.